Way News. I'm Jim Bertel. Tens of thousands of Lebanese have packed into central Beirut for the biggest anti-government demonstration since supporters of the militant Hezbollah group rampaged through their main protest site last week. The demonstration on Sunday came hours after a much smaller rally was held in support of Lebanon's president and foreign minister, two of the main targets of the anti-government protests. Protesters in Iraq's capital and the country's south shut down streets and government offices in a new wave of civil disobedience Sunday. Demonstrations broke out on October 1st in outrage over rampant corruption and unemployment in Iraq. They were met with violent crackdown that left dozens dead. Iran's supreme leader on Sunday again ruled out negotiations with Washington. VOA's Tommy McNeil has more.
Supreme Leader Ayatollah Ali Khamenei said Sunday, a day before the 40th anniversary of the hostage crisis at the former U.S. embassy in Tehran, that Iran will not yield to pressure imposed by its longtime foe, the United States. He added that holding talks with Washington will not solve Tehran's problems. He is quoted by state TV as saying that one way to block America's influence is to ban any talks with America. Tommy McNeil, VOA News, Washington.
Tens of thousands of Islamists at a protest camp in Pakistan's capital are awaiting a deadline set by their leader calling for the prime minister to resign. Cleric Maulana Fazlur Rahman led a caravan of supporters to Islamabad last week in a bid to pressure Imran Khan to step down, calling him an illegitimate ruler. Rahman has hinted he could direct his partisans to march on the seat of Pakistan's government and force Khan's resignation. Khan says he has no plans of quitting. For more news, please visit us at voanews.com. This is VOA News. Riot police stormed several malls in Hong Kong on Sunday to stop pro-democracy protests. However, violence did break out when a knife-wielding man slashed several people and bit off part of the ear of a local pro-democracy politician. Media reports say five people were injured, including two in critical condition. Nigel Farage, the pro-Brexit campaigner, says he will not stand in Britain's snap election, instead devoting his time to campaigning against Boris Johnson's EU withdrawal deal. Reuters' David Doyle reports.
Nigel Farage, the Brexit campaigner and leader of the UK's upstart Brexit Party, has said he will not run in the country's snap election. Farage is opposed to Prime Minister Boris Johnson's EU withdrawal deal, saying it binds the UK too closely to EU political objectives. His decision to field candidates in 600 constituencies in next month's election is a potential setback for Johnson, as it risks splitting the vote of Brexit supporters. But on Sunday, the Prime Minister said his deal was the only way to get Brexit done. Johnson also said it was a matter of deep regret that the UK had not left the EU on October the 31st, as he had pledged.
That is Reuters' David Doyle reporting. Air quality has dropped to its worst recorded level this year in New Delhi and nearby cities, with a thick haze hanging over the Indian capital. Reuters' Emma McCarthy has more.
Blanketed in a thick haze, a public health emergency was declared in Delhi as air quality dropped to its lowest recorded level this year on Sunday. In most areas of the city and surrounding areas, the air quality index breached the 999 mark, which, according to experts, is akin to smoking 40 to 50 cigarettes a day. Anything above 400 poses a risk for people with respiratory illnesses and can also affect those with healthy lungs.
That is Reuters' Emma McCarthy. President Trump has made no secret of his disdain for the Paris Climate Agreement. Now he's in a position to actually get out. AP's Ben Thomas reports.
My job is to represent the people of Pittsburgh, not the people of Paris.
That was President Trump speaking in Pittsburgh about 2 weeks ago. But he's been talking about getting out of the Paris Climate Agreement for more than 2 years. Starting Monday, he can finally formally start doing something about it. The deal took effect on November 4th, 2016, and stated that no country can withdraw in the first 3 years. Now the president can send a letter to the United Nations that begins the withdrawal process. It will take a year and become official the day after the 2020 presidential election. Ben Thomas, Washington.
A federal judge has blocked a Trump administration rule requiring immigrants prove they have health insurance or can pay for medical care before they can get visas. I'm Jim Bertel, VOA News.
morning and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotty in Washington.
We have signed the agreement so that we can bring a sustainable peace to the South Sudan. We didn't sign the agreement just to go back to the government or just to gain some powers and ministry. We are thinking about the people of South Sudan because this movement, the SPLM-IO movement, it's the people's movement, formed by the people, and working hard for the people of South Sudan.
Former South Sudanese Vice President Dr. Riek Machar agrees to a meeting to resolve issues regarding the full implementation of the revitalized peace agreement.
This parliament has agreed that this decision should be halted, but you're sure the university is going to restrict the resolution of the parliament that we have always done. And also we wrote a petition to the president, but up to now, the president has not yet listened to our petition or given us any conclusion on our petition that we wrote.
Makerere University students say they will continue their demonstrations until their demands are met.
There is no political life in Egypt whatsoever. Not a single 1 centimeter for any political for any political activity.
And a former Egyptian cabinet minister expresses concern about the government use of state institutions to silence dissent. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. Former South Sudanese Vice President Dr. Riek Machar will participate in a meeting organized by IGAD, scheduled to be held in the Sudanese capital Khartoum on November 8, according to Pok Both Balong, the SPLMO Director for Information and Public Relations. Organizers say the meeting will focus on evaluating the status of the implementation of the revitalized agreement. It will also look at the ways of resolving outstanding but critical pre-transitional tasks. Pok Both Galwang tells me the former vice president is committed to finding solutions that will lead to the full implementation of the agreement, which he says is the only way to attain lasting peace in South Sudan.
This meeting, according to the letter, is aimed at to evaluate the process of the implementation of the RCS task. And on top of that, aims at deliberating on the way forward for the pre-transitional period task. So we have accepted to participate in that meeting because of its importance. The people of South Sudan is yearning for peace, and yearning for a genuine peace is not just a fragile peace, because we don't want the country and the people of South Sudan to suffer again, because in 2015, the international community has urged us to go to Juba to form the government, and they have told us that we should address the outstanding issues within Juba. But unfortunately, we have failed. That's why we have decided that. We will not take part if the government insisted to form the unity government in November 12th without the outstanding issues to be addressed and implemented in letter and spirit.
What are Dr. Riek Machar's expectations in this meeting scheduled for next week, and what will be the takeaways if indeed he participates as he has agreed to do?
To us, we're not concentrating on expectations. The agreement was signed and agreed upon by all parties. Now, if the party, the other party, has political will, and they have the same political will that the SPLM, SPLM-IO, they're all lifting the burden from the people of South Sudan and the suffering that they have been through during the past 6 years. They should adhere to implement the agreement in letter and spirit.
Some people are saying that Riek Machar's refusal to participate in or to form the government as agreed in the revitalized agreement is perpetuating the suffering of the masses of South Sudanese that he seek to address. So on what grounds is he saying that he wants the people to be safe and want normalcy to be returned to South Sudan when he has refused to form the government, unity government that will restore peace and bring normalcy to the people, they said. What's your response?
To us, the agreement was pave a way for a better South Sudan and a reformed South Sudan. The agreement has 8 files that should be implemented. The security arrangement is the key or the backbone of this agreement, because there's no any security, proper security in all over the South Sudan. People are fearing their lives. And this culture of unknown gunmen is still in Juba. So we are towards us and SPLMIO. We have signed the agreement so that we can bring a sustainable peace to the South Sudan. We didn't sign the agreement just to go back to the government or just to gain some powers and ministries. We are thinking about the people of South Sudan because this movement, the SPLMIO movement, it's the people's movement formed by the people and working hard for the people of South Sudan. What's the benefit of forming the government while there's no proper security? What the need would be from government if the issue of the state has not been determined? And you're well aware that this state created by President Al-Fakir has not stand on whatsoever geographical or historical boundaries. That's a conflict, and this provision has to be implemented in the territory for the sake of people of Sudan. We have thousands of people that are living within South Sudan in the POC. We have millions of refugees that are living in the countries abroad. There's a reason for this to return to their houses and to return home. They cannot do that if there's no proper security arrangement. They cannot do that if there's no development, because the agreement has stated that should be that should be a development in all. They need roads, they need hospitals. This cannot be achieved if there's no proper implementation of the agreement itself.
Pork Both Balwang is the SPLMIO Director for Information and Public Relations. He spoke with me from the Sudanese capital, Khartoum. The student leadership of Makerere University in Uganda will meet striking students Monday to brief them regarding the latest development about their demands for rising fees to be scrapped, according to Judith Nalukwago, the Student Guild Vice President. She says the students are determined to continue with the demonstrations until all of their demands are met. Judith Nalukwago tells me there should be an independent inquiry into the brutalization of students by security operatives. This after calling for the suspension of two of the university officials he blames for giving the orders for the security officers to brutalize the demonstrating students.
Tomorrow, as student leaders, we sat down and we thought that it's important that we meet with the people we represent, because this leadership is supposed to be a consultative leadership. So in this demonstration, we've achieved something that is like 5% of what we wanted. So we want to explain to the students what exactly we've achieved, because some of them, we sent them in social media, but some of them have not understood. We want to give them the exact picture of what we have achieved, and we also listen to their feedback on how we should go ahead.
Professor Barnabas Nawangwe, the Vice Chancellor, issued a statement asking students to return to class, saying the situation was calm despite some hiccups. Why are you not adhering to his call for students to return to the classroom by you insisting that you will continue with the strike until your demands are fully met?
Students attending classes is not bad, but what is the point of students attending classes when in the long run they're not going to be exams? That is what we want to solve, because the tuition is so high, the students are attending class, but you cannot get an examination permit when you have not finished your exam, when you have not finished your tuition. So that is why we want the university to commit until the tuition is going to be halted, so that the student can do everything it takes to be able to find the little that is left so they can pay and be able to do exams. And this meeting we are calling for is to consult the students and see our way forward. It's not that we are saying that we as leaders, we are saying we should not stop the strike, but we want to consult the students. Should we continue with the demonstration? Because actually, at this point in time, our major goal is halting the tuition of this tuition policy has not been achieved. And that is the reason why we came for this demonstration.
Why are you calling for investigation into what you describe as the brutalization of students? Because I understand the police and the security operatives are just there to enforce the law to ensure that no laws are broken by the students who are on strike.
One is students are allowed to protest. Even our constitution gives them the right to demonstrate if they are not satisfied with whatever is going on. But the military and police came in and made it violent by beating students, by destroying all their properties, where they intimidate them and they stop demonstrating. Though recently they arrested the military commander who was in charge of that obliterating the students. Though as students we are not happy, because there are two administration members who ordered for that military to come and beat up the students. In fact, they gave us verbal scripts. They gave us scripts by text messages, and they told us they will switch off the cameras within the university, they will switch off the lights within the university, and they will beat the students, they will beat their property. But next day, it exactly happened the way they had narrated it. So we are asking the government, why aren't those people in administration being called to be investigated? Why are they investigating only the military people?
What happened to your petition to the president and parliament to review the tuition increment of 15% that you seek the university authorities to scrap?
We sent the petition to the president and the parliament, but actually what parliament did, they agreed that this tuition, they made a resolution that this tuition should be halted where it is so that the increment does not continue next year. But as we know in Uganda, many institutions do not respect resolutions of parliament. This parliament has agreed that this tuition should be halted, but we are sure the university is going to respect the resolutions of parliament like we have always done. And also we wrote a petition to the president, but up to now, the president has not yet listened to our petition or given us any conclusion on our petition that we wrote.
Judith Nalukwago is the vice president of the Makerere University Students Guild. She spoke with me from the Ugandan capital, Kampala. A former Egyptian cabinet minister is expressing concern that the government is using state institutions to silence dissent and clamp down on the opposition. Dr. Amer Darak says recent reports from both local and international media show political space is being narrowed, which he said undermines the country's democracy. He tells me the international community should pay closer attention to human rights abuses, which he says include the arbitrary arrest of citizens and accusing them of being spies.
This is not new. The current regime, after the military coup, has been doing this for years right now. But the extent and the severity and the brutal nature of the practice is increasing. And now they are targeting, as the Washington Post report indicates, they are targeting foreigners and they are targeting children as well. So this is not just for actions people did, but for what they may be sharing on their phones or writing via social media. So this is quite dangerous, actually.
The government is saying that it has a constitutional mandate to protect life and property. So if it will take any measures without breaking law to ensure that the country and its people are protected, what is the problem here?
Well, actually, most of these people were not arrested during the protest, actually. The protest started September 20th, and these people were arrested maybe starting September 23rd or 24th, and for several days. That was to prevent further protests. These people were not doing anything, and as the report indicates, they were arresting people just based on posts they have on their phones or material they are sharing, just news that are public, and this is considered crime. And they claim that people are spreading false news. So the people are actually trying to protect the stability of the country. It's the regime that is really, with these practices, is going to ruin the country.
But some of these people are believed to be spies working with foreign powers to destabilize the country.
This is quite strange. And actually, it is amazing. They are accusing people to be spies, for example, working with the CIA, while the USA is the closest ally to Egypt. So what harm is USA presumably going to do for Egypt if it is its closest ally? Actually, this regime is paranoid, and they portray anything, any kind of dissent or even expression of opinion as working with foreigners and working with spy agencies in order to destabilize the country. I don't know since when the CIA has been working to destabilize Egypt, so that the accusations are giving like that. How come the Egyptian authorities are treating foreigners like that while Egypt is trying to bring a lot of tourists for increasing the revenue of the country by through tourism? Which person in his right mind would come to Egypt and subject himself to such practices, actually?
But Dr. Darak, there have been instances where you've had attacks in some resort towns and in parts of the country. Supporters of the government are of the opinion that these are done by people using Egyptians to destabilize the country. Don't you think the government should do everything in its power to protect Egyptian lives as it is now?
Yeah, of course, this is the duty of the government, provided that this is the case, provided that people are working with spy agencies or foreign organizations to destabilize the country. But these are just actually false accusations to use them in order to justify the major steps they are taking. So this is nonsense. This is just some narrative that they are spreading in the media to get support of what they are doing. But actually, nobody is buying this anymore.
Opposition supporters, including yourself, are saying the government is using such tactics to narrow the political space or limit the political space for opponents to freely operate. But the government is saying that that is far from it and that opposition groups are being allowed to freely operate without any hindrances. How do you respond to that?
Well, actually, there is no political space right now. I'll be very happy if anybody can give me the name or the address of any political power that is working freely in Egypt right now, and I'll be glad to work with it and support it in public. Actually, there is none like that. Nobody in Egypt. I mean, people are blamed for whatever is written on their phones. So how come public political parties would be allowed to do any kind of opposition activities? There is nothing like that. There is no opposition, no political framework, not even political parties that support the regime. The parliament actually was formed by the security apparatuses, different security apparatuses. There is no political life in Egypt whatsoever. Not a single 1 centimeter for any political for any political activity.
Dr. Amr Darag is a former Egyptian cabinet minister. He spoke with me from the Turkish capital, Ankara. United Nations and private agencies are scaling up life-saving humanitarian operations in response to severe flooding across large parts of the Horn of Africa. For VOA, Lisa Schlein has more from Geneva.
Massive flooding following months of unusually heavy rainfall is wreaking havoc in Somalia, Kenya, South Sudan, and Ethiopia. The United Nations reports hundreds of thousands of people have been displaced, tens of thousands of livestock have been killed, property has been destroyed, and livelihoods shattered. Jens Laerke, the spokesman for the UN Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs, says an estimated 220,000 of the more than 500,000 flood-affected people in Ethiopia are homeless.
In South Sudan, flooding since July has affected more than 900,000 people, including internally displaced people, refugees, and the host communities where they live. The rains are likely to continue in South Sudan for another 4 to 6 weeks and put more people at risk. And we anticipate considerable damage to crops, arable land, and livestock.
Even before the rains began, Laerke says more than 3 million people were in need of humanitarian assistance. He says that number is likely to increase, especially as more than 60% of flood-affected counties are facing extreme levels of acute malnutrition. Similar scenarios of devastation are playing out in Somalia and Kenya. The United Nations says all four countries urgently need life-saving aid to recover from this disaster. Priority needs include food, water, shelter, and health care services. Agencies warn the flooding is causing an upsurge in waterborne diseases, malaria, and cholera. They say health promotion campaigns targeting flood-affected communities must be accelerated to prevent these illnesses from spreading. The United Nations is appealing to international donors for funds to support life-saving operations. A total assessment of needs has not yet been made. However, Laerke says the amount of money required will be substantial. For example, he says the UN estimates that South Sudan alone will require $35 million in emergency aid. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
And combat-ready troops were deployed to the Cameroonian capital Yaounde Saturday as supporters of Maurice Kamto defied a ban on protests against what they say is their stolen election victory. Supporters of the opposition party say their leader won the 2018 presidential election and that his victory was stolen. Kamto was to participate in the protest but is reportedly being held at his house by the police. For VOA, Moki Edward Kezaga reports from Yaounde.
Hundreds of supporters of Cameroon Renaissance Movement Party CRM demand Cameroon's government withdraw its anti-riot police from the esplanade of the Amadou Ahidjo Stadium in the capital, Yaoundé, so they can listen to the message their party leader, Maurice Kamto, has for them. Among the protesters is Etienne Tanke, a 39-year-old businessman who was arrested with Kamto on February 28 in the coastal city of Douala and detained in Yaoundé with Kamto until President Biya ordered their release.
Il faut que ce soit dit et redit. Maurice Kamto est celui qui est le vainqueur.
Tanke says he and his party supporters are reiterating that Kamto won the October 7, 2018 presidential election in Cameroon and that the long-serving President Biya stole his victory. He says he does not understand why each time their CRM party wants to organize peaceful protests, the government threatens them with charges of insurrection, revolt and hostilities against the state. Kamto and hundreds of his supporters were freed October 5. That's when Biya ordered an end to court proceedings against members of the Cameroon Renaissance Movement following calls from delegates to the national dialogue he held to address the country's crisis. The Saturday protest in Yaoundé was to be the first public meeting between Kamto and his supporters since he was released from custody. Christopher Ndong, Secretary General of the CRM Party, told VOA in a telephone interview that he and some party officials, including Kamto, were prohibited by the police from leaving a home where they met ahead of the protest. He says despite a heavy police presence, they are still committed to meeting their supporters who have been eager to hear from their leader.
We cannot let our fundamental rights be trampled upon. We are not afraid because what we are doing is within the law and it is our right. So you see, this is a government that is confused. They are in fact doing everything with impunity. We cannot be afraid because we are working and acting upon our rights.
Similar protests in the southern towns of Saint-Melima and Ebolova were banned by government. Kamto's supporters defied the ban in Saint-Melima, President Biya's hometown, and a confrontation Friday between CRM followers and those of Biya's CPDM party left at least six people injured. René Emmanuel Sadi, Cameroon Minister of Communication and Government spokesperson, says Kamto is not relenting from wanting to destabilize Cameroon. He says President Biya won the election with a landslide victory and Kamto should accept the verdict of the ballot or face the consequences as mandated by Cameroon laws.
We believe that Mr. Kamto and some warmongers among his supporters have failed to take full measure and to grasp the profound meaning of the presidential clemency welcomed by the entire national and international community.
The 2018 presidential election results showed Biya won a landslide victory with 71% of the vote. His strongest challenger, Kamto, was a distant second with 14%. If arrested again, Kamto could be charged with sedition, insurrection and inciting violence. Those are the same charges leveled against him when he defied a government ban on protest marches and was arrested in Douala. Moki Edwin Kinzeka for VOA News, Yaoundé.
Want to relax, unwind, or charge up? Then listen to Music Time in Africa this weekend. It'll do all that for you and more. I'm Heather Maxwell. I know good music. And Africa is my passion. Join me every Saturday and Sunday for 1 hour of commercial-free Pan-African music of the highest caliber. You get great music, music news, and amazing artist interviews from rising stars to superstars. This listen will take you places. So do it. Join me for Music Time in Africa, your weekend destination. We'll be right back.
This is The Voice of America, and you are listening to Nightline Africa. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, music from our African collection, and that will be followed by a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. But first, Richard Cormier is the reigning International Boxing Federation, or IBF, lightweight world champion. He is considered one of the top lightweights in the sport today. Cormier, a Ghanaian who hails from the capital Accra, is an experienced, tried and tested solid fighter with a lot of power in his right hand, which he uses to devastating effect. However, he has an upcoming bout with the mandatory challenger, Teofimo Lopez. Cormier joins me live in the studios here in Washington, D.C. to talk to me about his journey from his humble beginning right from the street of Accra to prime time. Richard.
How are you, Mr. Clothing?
I'm well, thank you. How are you?
I'm not too bad. Doing good.
Wonderful. So are you ready for your upcoming bout?
Yeah, most definitely. You know, boxing is a very tough sport. And, you know, I started off as, a kickboxer and then a soccer player. Mm-hmm. And then my friends were like, come on, man, why don't you try boxing? And I did. So ever since I said I'm going to try boxing, I train all year round. You know, I train after every fight, take 2 weeks off and then come back again. So it's kind of everything thing for me, you know? Yeah.
Don't you think you could burn out since you are training all the time because you know this is a dangerous sport and a tough sport? Don't you fear being burned out by the sport?
Yeah, definitely. I know definitely you can burn out. So when I mean by train every day, I train lightly, not that hard. And then when I know I've got a competition ahead of me, then I pick up the pace and then train. And then when I'm done with it, rest and then pick up slowly, you know? Mm-hmm. That's right.
So let me ask you this question, because there's this school of thought that African boxers are one way. They always want to knock down their opponent and not use skills to beat them. There's a saying here in America that skills win fight, not brute force.
That's right.
What are your thoughts?
Yeah, I think it's both ways. Skills does win a fight, and brute force also does win, because there are some people who are blessed with skill, but yet they don't work so hard. Then you get to a point, and the fitness or not working that catch up with you in the ring. And then so you just have to miss both. You know, you have to have both. And then once you have both and you listen to your trainer, you discipline, and definitely, you know, I mean, you work hard and God will definitely give you the victory that you always wanted.
How important is the relationship between the boxer and the trainer, and how critical is the boxer depending on the trainer's input and advice during the course of the fight to change or improve or win the fight?
I mean, it's everything. As a boxer, you know, you hire a coach who's going to look after you, going to tell you what to do, and it's like your life is in the coach's hands. So, you know, for every fighter to have, a great relationship and also go far in terms of boxing, you need to be like a family. You know, you got to be very close to there must be a loyalty, you know, there must be loyal between you two. And because you cannot hire someone who's just in there for the money or just in there, you know. Then if there's no money, he won't even care for you, you know. So it's all about family. And once you have someone that you feel, you know, you feel close to, you feel like when you're with this person, everything is all right with you, your mind is okay, you understand what I mean, then your spirit is good, then so be it, you know.
Recently, when you won the IBF title, becoming the world champion, you met the Ghanaian president, Nana Akufo-Addo, at the state of government at Jubilee House in Accra.
That's right.
When you are fighting, do you feel the pressure from the country? Because, you know, Ghanaians are boxing lovers.
That's right.
And sometimes they stay up all night just to watch your fight.
That's right.
How do you feel when you are going to fight and these people are calling you ahead of the fight? Does that encourage you? What does that do? Or
yeah,
does it put
it does,
too much
it
pressure?
It does encourage me, and I always want to, you know, I'm a kind of guy that I always want to fight for my people, you know, regardless of where I found myself. I fight for Ghana. I fight for my people because I grew up in Bukom, you know, the era, and I've got the passion. Actually, God gave me this. So I feel like if God has given me this thing to do as a boxing, it's always good to give back to these people, and I'm fighting for them. God hasn't given me this opportunity to do it for my own self. So I got to look at them. And anytime I think about them, it motivates me, give me the power that, yeah, I've got these people that they're looking up to me. So I got to make something new. I got to go there and win. I always want to put a smile on their faces. I don't want to let them down.
So what is it about Bukom
that generates all the Ghanaian world champions. So what is it about Buko?
They've got the fighting spirit there. They've got the fighting spirit in their blood. They want to fight. They don't care. They just want to fight. So that spirit in there. So when they travel outside, or they channel that into boxing, and then they get the right people to guide them, to lead them, and then definitely they're going to be world champions. As an example, you know, I can't go for where I am today, because even though I didn't start as a boxer, I started very late at the age of 23 years. I started very late, but I feel like God chose me to do this, you know. And thank God that He chose me, and He gave me a manager, and then this is where I am. Because initially, people thought I would be a soccer player. And then here I am, a world champion, one of the best in the world.
So tell me, when you are sizing up your opponent in the ring, first round, second round, when do you think that, okay, I have his numbers, I'll be able to defeat him?
Yeah, sometimes I feel, you know, for me as a person, when first round, when you touch me, I know I got you.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay. So talk to me about your American trainer, because I understand you have an American trainer.
That's right.
Has he improved your skills? Have you learned more skills in your arsenal that you will take to the ring?
Remember when I fought Robert Easter in 2016, I lost that world title with a split decision, even though I knocked him down.
Right.
But compared to when I moved here in 2017, I became totally different. Like, I can boss, I can move, I can do a whole lot of it. So, I mean, training with Andre Rizzi, Gary Stark, and Terrence has made me a better boxer. And ever since I started training with them, all my fights under them has been a knockout.
So do people train for knockouts? Because some people say these are knockout artists.
I never go into any fight. Even when I was in Ghana, I tried to knock anybody out. I just go there, listen to my corner, do what I have to do. When I see there's a chance, I take it. And then God gave me victory, and also God gave me the bonus by knocking them out.
Talk to me about the issue of body punches, because some people say that, oh, this guy is a body puncher artist, because they said when you go to the body, that's a sure chance of...
Right. Yeah, it slows your opponents down. So, you know, everyone believes that, the whole power from you come from your lower part of the body, from your legs to your lower part. So if the person go down and you're not conditioning properly, it makes you tired a little bit. You know, you get tired quickly, and then you stay. You don't want to move because you're tired. They've taken the energy out of you, and then they capitalize on you, and then, you know, they finish you up.
All right. So before we go, Richard, what should your fans expect in your upcoming bout?
Yeah, as far as they keep on praying for me, they should expect I'm retaining my title, and, you know, I'm going there representing my people. I'm going there to represent Gamashi. You know, I'm a Ghana boy. So, you know, Ghana, Africa, and the Gamashi has always backing me up. So definitely should expect that I'm retaining my title. And I wanted to be there in their numbers, because it's going to be a great night. And it's going to be, I mean, fighting the Mecca of boxing in the U.S., you know, it's not, I mean, I'm very excited, you know. And not every Ghana will get a chance to fight in there. So I want them to come there in their numbers, show support, and then, you know, we all do it together.
How does it feel to be a world champion?
Yeah, it feels great, because, you know, every boxer, like everyone, this is the dream of every boxer. From amateur to temple, you want to be a world champion. So for me as a world champion, you know, I mean, it's everything. It's not everything, but, you know, I've achieved what I wanted to achieve. But obviously there's more, you know. And also, I mean, he opens doors for you, you know. Let people respect you a lot, you know, when you're walking under the street, you know, people look up to you and you become a role model to others, which is, I mean, which is a real responsibility as a world champion. You got, you know, because you always have to show, you got to show yourself in a positive way that people will always admire you, you know, understand what I mean? So it's always great to be a world champion.
Thank you very much. Richard Comey is the reigning International Boxing Federation, or IBF, lightweight world champion. He joined me live in the VOA studios right here in Washington, D.C.
It's Sunday on Nightline Africa. This is the time we get to relax and reflect. A flashback with music from the continent. You're hearing from Flavor featuring Yemi Alade with Crazy Love, Eddie Kenzo featuring Pato Rangi with Royal, Jody Sugar with Coconut, and then Fally Ipupa ends it with Iloko Oyo.
She's back up.
my sister. Inspire every girl to add my feelings. Hey. Hey, there's a proud of you. Hey. I'm a papa, them proud of you. Say, say. I and I am proud of you. Baby, sweetie, I'm proud of you.
My baby, royal. Yeah. Royal, royal.
Only when you
are royal. Yeah. Royal, royal. My baby, royal. Yeah. Royal, royal. Royal,
royal.
You are royal. Yeah. Royal, royal.
On top, on top, top shot. Super celebrity
ranking on the lover, no.
Yeah.
Eddie Kenzo, lover, no.
Them call me the girl governor. Jungle, Africa, in a savannah. Where them get to your girl, see me now.
Sunday Music Spot. Hope you enjoy the music from Nightline Africa here at the English service of the Voice of America in Washington. Now let's take a closer look at Africa, the problems, the prospect in time of conflict, in time of peace. Here's Woman's Point of View with Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. Hello, Dr. Jonah.
Good evening, Africa. Although rugby is not as popular as soccer or football throughout the length and breadth of the African continent, every African should shout a hearty congratulations to the South African rugby team for winning their third World Cup by beating England 32-12 in Japan. No one had given South Africa any chance of winning this World Cup. It may also be recalled that at the World Cup in 1995, a few months after President Mandela assumed the presidency at the end of apartheid in South Africa, he made rugby a tool for national unity in the Rainbow Coalition, perhaps to the utter dissatisfaction of some of his more radical compatriots. Since then, efforts have been made to make rugby more of a national team. Hitherto, it had been the preview of the base of white minority in South Africa. And one could say that in 2019, that the rugby team of South Africa is more representative of South Africa itself. It has 6 black players, something which was unheard of in 1994, and it has the first black captain. So this victory is extremely meaningful for the people of South Africa. This has been achieved not easily. There have been turmoil within the rugby of South Africa, and the ranking of South Africa has been going down because of this disagreement. The reason why South Africa was not giving any chance this time was because there were disagreements among the players themselves, perhaps for the leading role that is being given to some of the black players. But what they have done on Saturday in Japan showed that much could be achieved by unity and hard work. Everyone thought England was going to win because of England's spectacular victory over the All Blacks of New Zealand and the struggling way manner in which South Africa defeated Wales to get to the final. So this is something which all South Africans are celebrating on today, Sunday, and beyond, because it's a step in the right direction. Now, one may ask, what will happen in the future? Well, we have seen also in Zimbabwe that there was an attempt to have a multiracial cricket club, and that caused problems. And these things will cause teething problems. But one must continue and to pursue this attempt at national unity. South Africa in the last few months have gone through very difficult times in the country. Riots, attack against foreigners. So this is a good achievement. And Mandela was right to select rugby as a symbol of national unity in South Africa. And despite all the problems, they kept something which all of us were taught as young boys and girls. If at first you don't succeed, try, try, try again. I thank you.
That was One Man's Point of View, a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. Nightline Africa comes to you from the English service of The Voice of America. Hope you enjoy the program tonight. As you know by now, we are on air on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC. From the Nightline Africa team, managing editor Shaka Sali, producer Saida Hamdoun, and our engineer for today, Al Santos, we say thanks for joining us. And remember, as the elders say, an army of sheep led by a lion can defeat an army of lions led by a sheep. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington. Good evening, Africa.
This is VOA.